Blog Talk Radio.
How's it going, everybody? Welcome to another fine edition of Puck Chatter Radio here on blogtalkradio.com, also simulcasting in delay on thethirdmanin.com, puckchatter.com. I am Chris Block, writer, editor, and keeper of thethirdmanin.com, here on this Wednesday night, September the 5th, 2012, 7 o'clock here in Chicago. Superstar, are you with me?
I am.
How you doing, buddy?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing great. A little bit before we get going here, a little bit later on in the show, we've got some CBA stuff to talk about. There's been some not so good developments there. And then also, we'll talk a little bit about, I just got back from a weekend in Las Vegas. I'm not exactly sure what happened out there, Superstar, but all I know is that I came home severely sunburned.
Well, that's pretty standard for you, isn't it?
Yes. But this one was really bad. This I think medically I'm actually a burn victim this time. But we'll get into that a little bit later on. But now we are pleased to have with us once again. This man not only was a highly accomplished junior hockey player in Niagara Falls and a Chicago Blackhawk for 8 seasons during the 1980s. He then went on to be a head coach at 5 different levels of pro hockey, including for the Tampa Bay Lightning. He won an IHL championship with the Detroit Vipers in 1997 and a Coach of the Year award just 2 seasons before that, 1995 in Muskegon. He has since gone on to become one of the most colorful, tell-it-like-it-is hockey commentators of his era. He was honored by his hometown of Etobicoke, I think I got that right, in their Hall of Fame in 2009. His best-selling book, Been There, Done That, is available at Ludvie.com. And, of course, he's one of our favorite guests, an old Chicago Blackhawks. He is Steve Ludzik. How you doing tonight, Steve?
Chris, that is the best and longest introduction I've ever got in my entire life. And I hear the superstar over there. The only superstar I know is superstar Billy Graham.
Yeah, you know it, man. How are you doing, buddy?
Good, great. Do you remember who superstar Billy Graham was? He was a professional wrestler in the 70s. He was the guy that Hulk Hogan stole all his gimmicks from.
That was way, way back in the day.
Yeah, back in the 70s.
Well, Steve, I had to give you a good introduction because the last time we had you on, I brought you in kind of quickly, and you gave me hell for it. So I needed
okay.
to deliver this time. Yeah.
You listen to regulations very well. Beautiful. Good job, Chris.
Steve, we've got a lot to talk to you about tonight. Obviously, you've been in the news a little bit lately. You always have a lot going on. You keep very busy. But before we get into a lot of that, one of the things that I wanted to talk to you about is that recently there's been a website that's come up that you've been heavily involved with, and it's called oldteammates.com. And
yeah.
Why don't you talk a little bit about this website, what it's all about, and how did it come to be?
Well, thanks for the plug. Oldteammates.com is a very unique website that I thought of about 4 years ago. A friend of mine died in I played junior and grew up as a kid with, and he was always a tremendous guy, and lost track of him for about 10 years, and in that 10 years, from 40 to 50, he became an alcoholic and basically drank himself to death in a basement apartment in Chicago. And he's a Toronto boy like myself, and we grew up, and I couldn't find anybody for his funeral. I couldn't locate any ex-teammates for his funeral. And it really bothered me. 4 guys showed up. And I said, geez, there's got to be a better place for old players. And I'm not talking just NHL guys, American League, or junior. I'm talking about all, like, whatever happened to that goalie that you played Pee Wee tournament in Quebec with? What happened to that guy that was a big scorer on your Bantam team? What about, you know, it's phenomenal. And you go to oldteammates.com, and you can find old teammates that you played with. It's a social network for not just hockey players. Hockey players have their own site, but it's for football, baseball, and basketball. It's extraordinary, actually.
But it's getting its start, you know, with hockey first and foremost.
Right.
Right now, it's just sort of looking at the website. It's more geared towards. It seems like the first guys are jumping on, or what you're talking about.
Hockey players.
hockey.
We just opened up a week ago, and we haven't done any. This is really the first show I've done about the old teammates. We haven't started promoting it or any. We're just done a soft launch. So we figure that we'll have 5 to 6 million people on this in a year or two.
And you said it took a while for you know, when the idea
4 years.
Came to you. 4 years.
4 years. It took 4 years, Chris. It was a lot of work, a lot of yelling and screaming at some guys, and it came to fruition. And my idea was that really, you know, those are some of your greatest times in your life when you're a kid playing sports and growing up, and those are the guys that probably understand you the best of anybody. So like I say, we got a great response from junior hockey players, and it's going to go, you know, Canada, the United States, Europe. We're going to be big in Europe, actually.
And if you, what's the response that you've gotten, even maybe before the thing went live, from guys that you know, interested in helping you out here, like promoting it a little bit for you?
Absolutely. Everybody's been just great. And they, you know, it's kind of, you know, when you tell people the idea, they go, boy, it's such a simple idea. Somebody must have thought of it before, but nobody has. And it's a unique endeavor. And it's actually a passion of mine to get this thing through. I'm fortunate doing down here, knowing more as a TV and radio guy, that I get a chance to promote the oldteammates.com on the air and radio and doing great shows like yourself to all the great Chicago fans out there. And you'll find all kinds of different guys on the site that you can talk to and Skype with. And we're just starting out, so it's going to be a slow process. But we've had a great response for the first week or two. And, I have a show called Ledzie's Lounge that you can punch into at my website and see me talk to Don Cherry and Paul Coffey and different guys like that.
Yeah, I just know that a few of the people that I talked to about it, since we talked about this last week, you know, kids that I knew that played high school hockey,
right.
Midgets Bantam, they think that it's a terrific idea, because when you get a couple of guys together, you all say, like, well what happened? Whatever happened to this guy? Didn't he end
Absolutely.
Up playing? And yeah, it's just a fantastic idea.
It's a great way of socializing with, you know, and we're going to keep building it, obviously. We're just in the infancy stage. But it's going to be a massive. Once it gets going, it'll be like a locomotive. It's going to pick up speed. And when, you know, we just started getting the word around right now just by word of mouth, actually. But it's going to be for every sport, actually, too. The guys I'm involved with, they talked me into doing the football and baseball. I just want to do hockey. But they talked me into the football, baseball, and so be it. You know, I'm not a baseball man. I'm not a football guy. I'm a hockey guy. But that's fine. It attracts all the eyeballs that you can get. And it's going to be very interesting. And I write a column down here in Niagara Falls, Where Are They Now?, which has been well received by the public. So I do a lot of – I can promote my website on that too.
And, again, that's oldteammates.com. And we'll put a link up on the
awesome.
Website when we put this up a little bit later on. And
thanks,
so everybody will know how to get there. Want to move on to a little bit more serious of a topic, obviously. You made news back in April, sort of, I think, shockingly to a lot of us, in a Globe or a Toronto Sun column, I believe. It was a Globe and Mail.
Right.
Article was written where you sort of unveiled that
exactly.
you've been battling Parkinson's disease for the past decade.
Yeah, over a decade, actually.
Yeah, 12 years. And
yeah.
I guess my first question, Steve, is in that 12 years, I mean, you were a coach,
mm-hmm.
and then you were a television person. I mean, you've been
mm-hmm.
in the public limelight that entire time. And this is something that you talked about in the articles, and Barry Rosner, the Daily Herald, wrote a terrific piece on
yeah,
you
did.
In June.
Thank you.
Just a fabulous piece, and we'll, if we can find that link, we'll throw it up there as well. But obviously there had to be a lot of internal conflict with you about coming out and, you know, sort of saying that this is what I'm dealing with.
Well, it's kind of a long story, but we've got a lot of time. I was diagnosed. I knew that I had something wrong when I was coaching in Tampa Bay. I was sitting on the porch with my wife one night, and my finger started to jump on my baby finger, and that was the first sign of it. And then my shoulder started aching really bad, and I just put it down to hockey, you know, injuries and so forth. And I understand that that's part of the game, but when it stayed with me for a year and then 2 years, I was like, I got to get, you know, I started developing a tremor in my left hand, and I'd drive the car and I'd say, geez, my left foot's moving a little bit. And I, you know, I'm a great bluffer too, eh? and an actor. And I just try to keep it concealed. And then I went to see a doctor and at home, and the doctor basically said, we got Parkinson's disease, and walked out of the room. That's all he said. So I said, what the hell? You know, you got to come back and tell your wife that, and you're 40 years old, you know. And I decided to keep it quiet, and then it got to the point, guys, where I was sitting on the sidelines and kind of watching the action going around and saying, hey, you know what? I can help this cause. I may not be Muhammad Ali, I may not be Michael J. Fox, but people do know me, and I can draw attention. And my thing is, I have a slogan called "Bash the Bully." Parkinson's disease really is a bully. It doesn't knock you out right at the start. It picks and picks and taps at you for 15 rounds, and it basically just wears you down. But I'm very fortunate, and people laugh and they say, fortunate. But I'm a very fortunate guy because the medication that I take and the care that I take, I really have minimal effects with the medication. It works with me. It doesn't take hold on some people. And it's just another obstacle. I guess they say part of being a good man is getting up one more time than you get knocked down.
Now the doctor comes in, and obviously it's shocking, and there's a lot, you know. But again, you were still, you know, you still had a coaching career. You're a very young man. Your mind had to be racing. You know, what's going to happen to me now?
Think that my only thing. Sorry to interrupt you, Chris, but. My only thing was I didn't really understand the disease, and it's kind of like a hush-hush thing, and I just didn't want to embarrass my family or be a burden on my family. That was my only wish was I didn't know how long this progression is, and probably with positive thinking. I mean, I don't know if I'm the smartest guy in the world, but I don't really worry too much about stuff like that. I can't do anything about it. That's what I got. So I try to ignore it. And you know what? When I was a kid, when I was in grade 6, I had trouble with a kid in grade 8. And I learned a real good lesson from my father. And I was coming home late from school every day because I was walking the long way around because this bully in grade 8. And that's 2 years difference, right, when you're a kid. And it was a bit, which is a big difference. And this kid, if I tried coming home the regular way, he'd be waiting for me and kick the living daylights out of me. And I came home one day with a black eye, and my mom was going for the phone. She said, I'll just call the school. And my mom was a very gentle soul. My father, on the other hand, it was not. And he told my mom to put the phone down, and he gave me a piece of advice. He goes, tomorrow when you leave school, go after that guy like 10 men. Put the drop on him. The exact words I can still remember was put the drop on him. And he won't bother you again. And make sure everybody sees it. So that's what happened. I didn't know talking in those terms now. You talk today, this guy must have been brought up like a barbarian, but... Back in the 60s, guys didn't carry knives and guns, and you know, you got to fight. But I never got another peep out of that guy, and that, so I've taught at an early age how to handle bullies, and I forgot that lesson, and that's one lesson my father taught me.
And for the people that don't know, Parkinson's disease basically it's a neurological disorder,
right?
Which obviously affects the brain. For people that you talk about bullies, for the people that didn't, you know, hear our last interview with you when you were 16 years old, and you were, I mean, you were Wayne Gretzky level basically. I mean, if, you know, I'm sure you'll be modest a little bit, but that's the level of a junior hockey player you were at, and at 16 years old, you were diagnosed with Crohn's disease.
Yeah,
so, I mean, you're no stranger to the battle.
No, exactly, and I think that probably helped me and held me in good stead, Chris, because that was probably one of the lowest points of my life at 16, leading the league in Toronto and scoring for 6-7 years, and then you get sick, and then I was shocked. My weight went from 160 to 130, and I kept trying to play. I was playing against guys that were 20 years old, and I was shocked at how quick people forgot you. maybe that put a little bit of a chip on my shoulder, I would say, or a way of keeping people away from me, because I realized right then and there that people don't give a damn what you did yesterday. They care what you did today. And it did sting. It really did sting. And I think my old owner that bought the team and drafted me, they drafted me in the seventh round, and he was honest enough in my book. He says, if I hadn't been sick, I would have been drafted first, second, or third overall. But things are meant to be for a reason, and that was one thing. And it taught me a great lesson that I could come back from. I'd never been hurt at that time. I took my health for granted, but I never took it for granted again. And when I broke my shoulder or broke my sternum or broke my foot in Chicago, that was like nothing for me. Like, I play with pain, play with a sore back, play with a bad knee, that was nothing. You try playing a game when you're 16 years old against guys with beards and mustaches and they're 8, 19 years old and weighing 130 pounds and you're deathly sick, that's tough. That's when you really find out what you got.
Now, I want to segue into, because you've been very outspoken that you believe that Parkinson's has come to you directly based on concussions and headshots that you took over the course of your career. You figure you had about 6 concussions during your playing career?
At least that. And trust me, believe me, nobody has more respect for the game of hockey than Steve Budzik, nor the guys that came before me, nor the guys that come after me. And it's changed my thinking. I was always a big proponent of teaching kids how to hit at a young age, teach them how to roll off a hit and so forth. But I've changed that thought process now because I watch these kids playing, and I'm talking about 6, 7, 8-year-old kids, like going for heads with body checks, and that was not uncommon. Everybody thinks that it's just happened now. But it happened in our day, and like you said before, I was the guy that carried the puck all the time when I was a kid. That was our poverty breaker when Junior was waiting for Ludzie to come pick it up and take it down the ice. Well, you take some pretty good shots. And, you know, I liken it, Chris, and Superstar, that it's like going to bumper cars at the fair. You can do that for about 3 minutes, and they get you off the bumper cars, just banging each other, bang, bang, bang in the bumper cars. But you do that for 25, 30 years, and you're not going to be the same. So I don't give a damn. I don't care what some doctors say. It's my body. I know exactly what was going on. And I have no doubt in my mind. Like, they talk about viruses and stuff like that. Well, that might be, you know. People say to me, how come Muhammad Ali has so much trouble with Parkinson's? And George Shivala, who was a great Canadian fighter in Canada and took 1,000 blows to the head, talks perfectly. That's just the way the body was built. He had a thicker skull and was able to absorb or act like he was absorbing more punishment. Ali actually took a lot of punches too, but didn't take, you know, it took a greater effect on him. And that's, I think you're going to see, and I got a lot of heat from saying that by some people who had the guts to say it to me. But they said, well, it's not hockey. Well, you can't tell me it is, and I can't tell you it's not. Like, they said, well, it's not been proven. Well, yeah, it hasn't been proven. It wasn't from getting hit and body blasted and stuff. And I'm not saying necessarily guys hits to the head, but hits to the chest. You got to understand how a concussion happens, how brain damage happens. You're skating 35 miles an hour, and you body check a guy. Your brain's still driving that same 35 miles through until it hits the edge of your skull. You can get knocked out by taking a body check. People don't understand that. It's not just headshots. You know.
Now,
but I don't blame. I certainly don't blame. Blame hockey. I mean, that was my life.
Now, I want to double back here for a second, just clarify. You know, are you opposed to, you know, when you talk about 6, 7-year-old kids running around trying to check each other? I mean, one of the things that I'll just say, one of the things that I've observed, and I don't know, just because of the speed of the game, especially at the higher levels, that this could necessarily be avoided, but it seems like kids don't learn the proper way to hit. And some of, like you just mentioned, some of this is unavoidable when you're playing the game at the speed you are.
Yeah, that's right.
Should there be no hitting until a certain age?
Oh, no question. I think that, and my mind's changed. I used to never think this way, and I think you're going to see a lot of people sway this way. Hockey's a game of skill, finesse, and strength. And I really think that the game, the skilled players, there can be more skilled players if they focused on that at a young age. Worry about skating. Worry about stick handling. Work on your passing. Work on your playmaking. Work on learning the game. Never mind running a guy from behind at 60 miles an hour into a pane glass. That doesn't do anything. They got to get rid of guys like that. I really mean that. And I think if you look back in history and you look at, like I'm an avid hockey historian, Bobby Hull tried a sit-down strike in the WHA in the 70s. And he refused to play against the Birmingham Bulls, I believe it was, who had a pile of idiots. Well, it killed the gate in Birmingham because Bobby Hull wasn't playing. He said, I'm not playing against this team. Drawing attention to it. And then you had the Dave Schultzes and the Philadelphia Flyers where they just pummeled living daylights out of guys. And that changed the game again. Then you see what happens. The Edmonton Oilers came around and it changed the game back for the better. Everybody wanted. You see, there's a blueprint out there. And a lot of people aren't smart enough to go with their own style. They say, well, that's the way to win. Be like Edmonton Oilers. But there's only one Edmonton Oilers. Only one. You're never going to find another team like that ever again. The teams they had in the 80s. And we, unfortunately, in Chicago, and I think Gretzky just came out the other day. My sons were telling me he came out and made a statement that the team that probably would have won Stanley Cups in the 80s besides the Oilers were the Chicago Blackhawks. That's quite an utterance from Gretzky, you know?
Yeah, you know, I mean, that was the team that you guys couldn't conquer. But,
yeah,
I mean,
nobody was going to beat them. And I can tell you this much, they would have beat the daylights out of every team today. They got about 10 guys in the Hall of Fame now. I mean, it was just a remarkable and somewhat lucky that they grabbed the players they did. But it was, and you think how good our team in Chicago? We stretched them to 6 games one time, one playoffs. We almost had them. And they were scared to death of us to play us because we had a physical team. Like I know I'm waxing apples here a little bit, but like the North Stars, people don't realize how good the Minnesota North Stars were, and we always usually finished a little bit behind them in the playoffs, but we never worried about them in the regular season. They were always a little bit ahead of us. We never worried about them in the playoffs because we knew that we'd grind them down, and by seventh game, they didn't want to play anymore, and that's a fact. That's a fact.
I want to talk, you know, I got a bunch of questions about the 80s Blackhawks, the party line, and, you know, some of those old series. But before we get to that, I want to just a couple more things on the concussions.
Right.
When you played, and you know, I know that you suffered some big hits, but you know, and we've talked before about how, you know, back in those days, I mean, you were scared to be hurt. You were scared if you were hurting, you were scared to say, I mean, I just need a night off because you would lose your job.
Absolutely.
I mean, we didn't know much about concussions 25, 30 years ago.
No.
But thinking back on it, or even at the time, maybe, when you were playing, did you know that there was something wrong?
No, to be really honest. You know, trouble getting out of bed in the morning, but I remember sometimes just crawling out of bed, it's so sore from the night before. But that was to be expected. Once you got up and walking around, you're fine. I remember getting hit in Minnesota one night by a guy from behind, and my face went right in the glass, and I really didn't wake up until we got back to the airport in Chicago. I was with Daryl Sutter and Larmer and Rick Patterson, and I never said a word the whole way back on the flight. I remember that very well. But you don't say anything to anybody because you don't want to lose your job. You want to lose your job, and so be it. And that's not me. That's everybody. Tom Lijak, he played with a bad back. He didn't want to sit out. He didn't want to lose his spot because he might not get it back.
Right, and I think just to expound on that, because I think this is really really important moving forward, because especially I don't know if this is exclusive to hockey, probably isn't, but in a sport like hockey, I think this is important to sort of note moving forward, because I don't think that culture necessarily goes away. Speaking about the Blackhawks have two players currently, that Swedish center Marcus Kruger and defenseman Steve Monitor, who last season had issues with concussions.
Right.
They had a concussion. They came back. They played one game, and they were right back out with a concussion.
Right.
I think I don't think that's necessarily going to go away, where guys feel like they have that you know those symptoms, but they don't want to say anything because maybe in the case of Steve Monitor this past year, he wasn't playing very well. He was in danger of losing his position in the lineup.
Right.
Marcus Kruger fighting to get on the second line with better players, didn't want to be out of them. I don't think that culture is going away where guys are hiding symptoms, trying to cheat the concussion test. And I think that that's the scary thing about this moving forward.
Well, I can tell you that they sure look after the players a lot better, which they should be nervous about the kids with the concussions and so forth. And you're never going to take that fear of your job out of it's not a great way to play hockey, worried about coming to the rink every day, whether your sweater's hanging up or you're sent down. It can't be fun. I'll point out a spot. Like, my advice to Sidney Crosby is retire, because he's going to get it again. And people don't think so. They say, well, nobody's going to hit Crosby because he's got a big safety net around him because nobody wants to hit him. Are you kidding me? You watched the playoffs last year against Philadelphia. Guys were punching him in the back of the head. There's no respect at all.
Well,
they get into warfare.
With Claude Giroux in Philadelphia. He's a target.
Yeah, exactly. And that's just the nature of the beast. It's a mean game, and that's just the way she goes. And you give no quarter, and you expect none either. But Crosby's got enough money to, air condition hell if he has to. He doesn't need the money. He wants to play for pride. But money's no good to you if you're 50 and you have a hard time getting out of the chair because you can't find your way. It doesn't do you any good at all.
I want to move on to some lighter topics. First of all, for the past two seasons, you've been given a chance by the Blackhawks. You've been brought into Chicago, a guest at the United Center for some games, doing autograph sessions. How did that all come about? And tell us about that experience.
Well, I was really honored that Cliff Coral from the Blackhawk alumni called me the last couple of years, and I think it was in February or so that I came down both years, and I really had a ball and saw some of the old guys, Peter Marsh and Grant Mulvey and Reggie Kerr and guys like that. I try to keep in touch. Matter of fact, interesting story, I got a call this summer by Tom Lysiak, who was being inducted into the Polish National Hall of Fame in Troy, Michigan, and he asked me if I would be the presenter of his induction speech, and it was quite an honor. Two old Polacks sitting together at the front of the podium having some fun.
Tommy looks great
for all the people that are watching this. Tommy Lysiak looks tremendous.
Is he still living down in Georgia?
Yeah, he's still living in Georgia, and he has got a gorgeous wife, the same wife he had. You know, they say in hockey, the first thing that goes not your leg is your money or your shot, it's your wife. Tommy's still married to the same woman, Linda, and he's got a beautiful daughter, and Jessie, and who's a model, and he lives a quiet life up in Atlanta. Just one of the greatest guys I ever met in the game. Really was. We had a lot of fun, and it was really sad the day he retired. He was a lot of fun. He was a man's man. When he told you you're going for lunch, you're going for lunch at Tufano's, and it could be an all day, and you might eat supper there that night too.
It was Mondays that you guys had.
You know too much. I'm worried about you. You know what? We used to go to Tufano's on Mondays. We used to go there and have lunch, and have a few nectars of the gods. And we really had a close team. We really had a lot of fun. We really, really, really did it. We had a lot of great guys. I mean, I don't remember one bad apple in that barrel. And I think that you give Pulford a lot of credit for that, because he wouldn't put up with a bad boy. He would have got rid of him quick.
Since you mentioned him, thought just comes to my head. Bob Pulford, for pretty much, I mean, every Blackhawks fan, and I think with Pulford it's more about, you know, general managing and being a part of the team sort of going south, especially in the 90s. But, I mean, when you talk to players, and I've talked to you, you know, last time we had you on, you mentioned this. Almost to a man, everybody seems to really, really love Pulford. Tell us about Pulford, interacting and dealing with Pulford as a player.
Well, that's an excellent question. He was a general manager my entire tenure in Chicago. Was like a father figure to a lot of guys. Very smart, very quiet, very great competitor. Smoked a lot of cigarettes. You knew he had a rough day when his hair was completely white from gray. And you knew he'd had a bad day when his hair was all nicotine stained from having cigarettes smoking all day and getting smoke into his hair. But you know, he did something really interesting that I stole from him was that after a game we got beat once in a while, and if we got a bad beating, he'd say, he'd come in the dressing room, and instead of blaming us, he'd blame himself. And he'd say, I was no good tonight. I didn't have it behind the bench. I just wasn't myself tonight. And you'd hear guys say, no, Pulley, that's bull. You were great. We thought we were. And he had a way of making you feel ashamed after you lost the game that he felt that way about himself.
Now,
but he had another great thing was when we won, he'd always come by and ruffle your hair, which was, I mean, you look forward to that.
One of the stories that you told in your book, and again, I want to plug it because, and I'm not saying this because, you know, you're on the show.
Right.
I'm not a fanatical reader. I read about a chapter of a book and then I'm passing out. But been there, done that. I really mean this. I couldn't put it down. The anecdotes that were in it, the stories, and I know a lot of people that listen to this were. You know, just little children in the 80s. Some of them weren't even born in the 80s.
But yeah, exactly.
Whether you're a Blackhawks fan, whether you were a fan in that era, whether you don't really recall that era, this is a fantastic book because it's just story after story after story. And like we said, you spent almost your entire NHL career in Chicago. It's
right.
Very Chicago eccentric. I mean, it's a terrific book. But one of the stories that you tell in the book, and you tell us a little bit about now, is you talk about Pulford and stealing. He would come into the dressing room and steal your guys' cigarettes.
Yeah. Well, first of all, thanks for the plug about the great compliments about the book. And it's one of the most proudest things I've ever done was to write that book. And it is an excellent. And I love hearing from people, especially people. You don't have to be a hockey fan. And it is a fun read. And it became a bestseller in Canada. And I know a lot of people in Chicago enjoy the book. And sometimes guys write me and email me and say, my wife banned me to the garage when I read it because I laugh so hard, which I thought was hilarious. But especially hockey players, if they play at any level, they really enjoy the book. What was your question?
About Pulley coming into the dressing room.
Yeah, I never smoked cigarettes. So I never was one of the guys, but he would come in, he would wait till the guys went on the ice to practice. And he would go to Savard's stall and take four or five cigarettes out of his, go to Larmer's stall, take seven or eight cigarettes of his, Greg Fox, go to Tommy Lysak, and he'd pick up his cigarettes for the day to smoke, or for that morning, any which way, 'cause he smoked a lot. Like, he would inhale a cigarette, and you'd be talking to him, and the smoke never came out. Like, you'd wait and see, that's got to come out of his nostrils or something, and he'd inhale it, and it'd be gone. I understand Pulley does not smoke anymore. And, you know, one of the greatest things that happened to me was when I was coaching in Florida with the Panthers. Pulley's not a very talkative guy. He came down to the ice level before the game. He got backstage, and he just came over with Ledzie and Prouty, and he did the old ruffle of the hair, right? And Rick Dudley made a funny comment, and Pulley didn't take it as a funny comment. Ledzie didn't know what he was doing. Something I can't remember what it was. And Pulley was on the defense. He knew what he did, and he did it every night. And that was, to me, that was money in the bank. But he was tough to negotiate for contract. I mean, the good Lord and the 12 apostles wasn't going to get me any more money. he's tough to deal with on the financial side of it. And he's a good man. He was a very good man. He had a lot of old-fashioned thinking, and he liked a certain player, and I can't say anything bad about him. I really can't. He never bothered me. He's always very nice to me, and I respected him very much.
Speaking of mentors, I put this video up on our website, thethirdmanin.com. In the winter of 2011, I thought it was just an amazing thing that Steve Larmer and yourself, your really good friend Steve Larmer, took a trip to Cornwall to visit your old coach and the guy that gave you two a tremendous break when he moved up from Moncton to coach the Chicago Blackhawks, Orville Tessier. You guys went up to visit your old coach, and again, we'll put the video up on the website tonight, but just talk a little bit about how all that came about, because Orville, I mean, in the video you can see he really seemed genuinely touched by that gesture.
Well, he was the guy that helped us get to the top. And I got a phone, I'm getting kind of emotional here. He was, he's a guy that really gave Larmer and I a chance to play in the National Hockey League. And he's like a lot of guys, not what you see on the outside, it's what's inside. And he was actually a very good man. He still is, he's still alive. He called me and said, you know, I'm not feeling that great. Can you come up and see me? And he lives in Cornwall, Ontario. And he has 10 stents in his heart. It's real bad heart. And I called Larms and said, why don't we go up and see him? And Larms said, for sure. We went up and we met him in his apartment. And we went out for lunch with him. And he has not changed. He doesn't have that bacon strip of hair hanging across his head like he used to have. He's cut that off with his bald head. But his bark wasn't like his bite. He was a blustery guy. He could ball you out on a Friday night and buy a coffee Saturday morning. He never held a grudge. So he was instrumental. Like Steve Larmer would not have played the National Hockey League if it wasn't for Orville Tessier. And people say, and Larmer, we were just with him last weekend. We were golfing together. Literally, Pulford was going around the dressing room with the trainers. And I'm packing all the gear up for guys, and he'd say, that guy stays, that guy stays, that guy goes. And I think the part of the team was in Springfield. And Orville Tessier, who had coached us in Moncton the year before, when we won a Calder Cup, happened to be walking through, what do you imagine? Happened to be walking through the locker room when Pulley was making the team. And Orville said, what are you doing with Larmer's bag? And he said, well, he's had a crappy camp, and we're sending him down to Springfield, wake him up. And Orville said, no, let me. I got carte blanche. I'm supposed to have carte blanche who plays in this team. Let me try him out with Savard. And as they say, the rest is history. Larms went on to have a great career, won Rookie of the Year that year. But me and Larms just always joke and say, what happens if Orville hadn't been walking through the dressing room at that time? History would have been changed. And, a great thing about Orville was that he used to always say that we were two of his favorite players, but that didn't exclude you from getting your butt chewed out from him, because he'll tell you what, he could take a strip off you quicker than anybody I've ever seen in my life. When the lava flowed when he gave his speeches, it was unbelievable.
Now, speaking of Steve Larmer, I know how you feel about this next question, but this is a hot topic continuously, all the time with Blackhawks fans. Make the case for me for Steve Larmer in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
Well, the case would be that anybody looks at the record doesn't know hockey players. If you have to look at a guy's record, goal scoring or assists and that, you don't know him as a player. Steve Larmer, if you ask him how many goals he scored, he couldn't tell you. If you ask him how many assists he got, he probably couldn't tell you. But he's reliable as a Rolex watch, as a player and as a friend. And he played every night. And not knowing, to me, I say it controversially, he's one of the toughest players I ever played with. Never got a fight, never really body checked a guy, but he played with an inordinate amount of pain. When we were in junior hockey, he shattered his scaphoid bone our second year. And the doctors came to me after they'd x-rayed him at the hospital and said, he's done for the year. It's the scaphoid bone, the hardest bone in your body to heal, and he's done for the year. Well, the next day we're leaving for Windsor to play the Spitfires, and he comes on the bus, packs his stuff, but he's got a cement caster on his wrist. And took a rasp and shaved the palm of his hand all the way down to Windsor, which is about a three-hour, four-hour bus ride. And proceeded to tell me before the game, he goes, I'm just going to stand outside of the net, 6x4, 6x4. I got no strength in my top hand. I can't shoot. I can't shoot the puck. So I said, yeah, okay. we're getting ready for the game dressing. And he says, remember now, I can't shoot. Can't shoot the puck. My hand, I can't feel my hand. He had some painkillers in him. First shift of the game, I grab the puck, go over the blue line, and drop it back to him. Just that instant, he lets a bomb go. Top shelf, past Roley Melanson, who was the goalie for the Windsor Spitfires. Just blows it by him. The howitzer. And we come back to the bench, and everybody's howling, and like they never seen anything like that. And Larms turns to me and says, I thought I told you not to pass me the puck. I can't shoot. I said, Jesus, Larms, you just blew like a 60-footer by Roley Melanson, top shelf, top glove, top cheese, whatever you want to call it. But he's for the Hall of Fame. He should be in the Hall of Fame. Will he get in? I don't know. I don't know what these graybeards are thinking. I can't speak for him. He never really garnered that much fan attention, nor did he want it. My wife and his wife were very close, and we grew up playing junior hockey together and played pro for 10 years together. And he would be the first guy to the dressing room after a game. He didn't want to talk to the press. He just wanted to, you want to be the first guy at the bar, get his feet up and have a cigarette and a beer. And that was Larms. He was just an easygoing guy. And just a tremendous guy to play hockey with.
Now, and part of that personality was how you came. It was a few years before that, but you were the one that coined him with the nickname Gramps in junior.
Yeah, man, I don't know. You must have read the book 3 or 4 times, Chris, because you've got some good stuff. It's a great, excellent interview. I was a 7th-round pick to junior because I was sick the year before, as I mentioned earlier. Larmer was the first pick. And the whole summer, I didn't know who Steve Larmer was. We played against each other a couple of times. He played for Peterborough. I played for the Marlies in Toronto. I really had no idea who he was, but I pinned my hopes and determination. I was going to knock him out, not physically knock him out, but I was going to prove I was a better player than him right from the day one of training camp. I was going to go after him. And when you know what, they put him on my line with my best friend, Johnny Kirk. And we were together for 3 years in junior, and we dominated. And I tried not to like him when I first met him, but he was impossible not to like. But he was like an old man. I mean, he was 16 years old, and he was sneaking cigarettes behind the portable at school, and he was always laid back. And I said, you're like an old grandfather. We're going to start calling you Grandpa. Well, the nickname caught on, and it stuck. I still on the golf course. I said, nice shot, Gramps.
Daryl Sutter tells a great story, and I off the top of my head, I don't know if – You guys all drove in from the western suburbs.
Yeah.
Practice. It was Daryl, you, Steve Larmer, and was it Rich Preston? Or Nick,
well,
Rick
Rico used to come with us once in a while, but it was usually Russ. You know, you talk about great guys. Rich Preston's right at the top of the list. I know history doesn't tell you how great a player Rich Preston was. I mean, I'll tell you how good he was when I came back from my first rookie. When I was 18 years old, I came back from my first camp in Chicago. Three players stuck out to me. Dennis Savard was the best thing I'd ever seen in my life. He was literally possessed to prove that he was the best player of that draft, because he was insulted that he was a third player picked, if people remember that correctly. Rich Preston was the most complete player I ever saw, the nicest guy that you ever are going to meet. And Tom Lysak did more stuff with his feet and his stick in tight to his feet than I'd seen anybody. Those are three guys that immediately stood out to me. But it was Rick Patterson usually that drove with us.
Well, Daryl tells the story that you guys would drive in from the suburbs together, and the entire drive, he and Preston or Patterson would be completely silent, and you and Larmer would be in the back arguing about everything.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Daryl Sutter tells that story. That's the truth. Yeah, we would argue about everything. Like, we would argue about stop for a coffee, who's wearing socks, who's not wearing socks, how much gas is in the car, is it raining out, it's not raining out. You got to remember, Larms and I knew each other really very, very well. And one thing about Larms is he was grouchy on the ice, too. Patty Graham was our winger the last 2 years in junior, and he was, in our second year, he was put on our left side. And the first shift he played with us, Larmer chewed into him for about 2 minutes on the ice. Don't dump it in the corner. What are you doing? Get the puck to Ludzie. What are you doing standing over there, too? And they get back to that spot, this man. And Patty Graham looked at me and said, is this guy for real? But that's the way Lawrence was. He's like an old man and grumpy. Grumpy grandpa, I guess. But that's the true story. I remember one time driving down to practice, and I told the boys we were taking the roof off my car. I had a Z28 at the time with a convertible top. And Daryl said, Ludzie, if I drive downtown with this roof off, I'm going to get a cold. By the time we got down to Chicago Stadium, which was a 45-minute drive, he had a sore throat. The fact that it was December may have been a contributing factor.
Was there any one guy in particular that when you came up to the minors and you turned pro that really took you under your wing or their wing?
Yeah, Terry Ruskowski did. That's a great question. Great question. And I never forgot it. Ruskowski, my first year pro, I think I was up for about 2 months with the Blackhawks, and then Pulley came to me and asked me, he said, you can stay, but you're not going to play very much, or you can go to New Brunswick and with the Hawks, and you got a chance to win a Calder Cup maybe, right? And it was a no-brainer because I really desperately wanted to play hockey. I didn't want to sit and watch other guys. And the interesting thing about Ruskowski, I lived at his house with his wife, Carol, and he was just tremendous to me. And, you know, when I look back now, he must have, in his mind, and it happened to me with Jeremy Roenick, in his mind, Ruskowski was probably saying, this son of a, you know what, is probably going to take my job and bump me out of a job. I was a centerman, so was Terry, and that's eventually what happened. But he was total class, the toughest. He was like a warthog. People remember him in Chicago. He was a very short guy. We used to call him Tattoo. And I don't think you ever saw him lose a fight. He's a tough Polish guy, and he was tremendous to me and really took me under his wing. Matter of fact, I still talk about it. The first goal I scored in the National Hockey League was in Quebec against, I can't remember what his name was, a French-Canadian goalie. And I took a slapper and scored in my first game, and he took the puck and was supposed to get it mounted for me. Came to me about 3 weeks later. He goes, Ludzie, I lost the puck. I said, you're a better man than me. I would have just grabbed any puck and mounted it. You know, so he came to me and goes, you're not going to believe this. I lost the puck. I can't find it. It's gone. It had the Nordique symbol on it and the National Hockey League thing on. I said, you're a better man than me. I would have just grabbed any puck and slapped it on. I would never know the difference. But he wasn't a great skater. But he got the job done. But he was like a badger. He was like tough. Like, I mean, he took on guys like Larry Playford, who was like 6'6", 260. He was like you look at the YouTube, and I'm sure you guys do. You watch some of the battles he fought guys like Steve Durbano, guys like that. I mean, Terry Ruskowski was maybe 5'7". If 5'7", but he could play, and he had a big heart, and he had big kahunas. So that's why he was captain of the Chicago Blackhawks. And he didn't play an extraordinary long time because the style that he played, and that's what people don't understand, is the style that you play dictates a lot of time. The only guy I've seen play a vicious style and last a long time was Mark Messier and Gordie Howe. But there will be one near Gordie Howe he just straightened a couple guys in the start and he got a lot of room. But the toll it takes on certain individuals, some guys are old at 27, some guys are young at 31. It's a strange DNA in you. Like me, by the time I was 28, I was almost shot. I knew I was almost done. And I looked after myself very well. But I had such horrific injuries playing a style that wasn't natural to me that it really changed my physical being. Yeah, no question.
A few more questions before
no
we
problem.
Let you go. One of the things about the 80s Blackhawks, and again, that's my youth, but that team was so good for so long.
Yeah.
But one of the things that made that team so complete was, and there's a line that I remember in particular. I don't think you guys were together very long, but I mean it was hell on wheels. I mean you guys really stirred up a lot of stuff on the ice, but you were also very effective. Yourself on the left wing, Kurt Frazier in the middle, and Tim Higgins on the right side. Were there any other guys that you, in particular that you really enjoyed playing alongside?
Well, that's another great question. Actually, I was a center. Kurt was the left winger, and Higgy was my right winger. And I don't know what they called our line. I don't know if we had a name. I'm not even quite sure we had a name, but we gelled right near the end of the hockey season, my rookie year. And we really had a tremendous series against the Minnesota North Stars and the St. Louis Blues. And then what happened was, people don't know this, that Kurt Fraser was a diabetic, and he did not know it. And I remember playing against the Oilers in the semifinals, and he constantly asked me, how do you feel, Leslie? And I said, well, I'm sore a little bit, but it's just semifinals, right? And Kurt Fraser would say, I'm just tired. I'm exhausted. Well, he went and got his pilot's license that summer and found out he was a diabetic, which has been a serious problem for him since then. But just what a competitor. We would crash and bang and stir it up, and we'd play against the other team's best lines, like the Cicerelli, Bobby Smith, Tommy McCarthy line. And I loved playing with those guys. But I was usually the guy that played with the guy that came up from the minors or something like that. And I don't really remember any regular line mates. I played Billy Gardner and Rick Patterson once in a while. But I'd usually play, you know, penalty kill and stir it up a little bit. Kurt Fraser, I mean, it gave you a lot of leeway. You could live off to a lot of guys on the ice because Kurt Fraser has hands on him like Sonny Liston. He had the biggest hands I've ever seen on a man in my life. And he'd, you'd see sharp or be flat with him because he was a tough guy. And Higgy was a tough. Higgy was a very tough guy.
And Tim Higgins was, especially for that era, he was a big guy. I mean, he was only maybe 6'1 ish, but, I mean, he was pretty thick and a big guy for that era.
Well, he was fearless. I mean, he used to do stuff that could get you mad once in a while. Like he'd wind up with these big forays down the ice, like at Bobby Hall, right? And he'd get to the blue line and take a slap shot from outside the blue line and come back to the bench and he'd go, how'd that stay out? How'd that goalie get that? And Fraser would go, hey, the shot from the blue line, most goalies are going to stop that. But he was just, Higgy was just a beautiful man. And one of the first guys to call me when my story appeared about Parkinson's was Tim Higgins, which I had not heard from Higgy for a long time, and he got word of it. And Dennis Savard was the next guy to call me from Las Vegas, which really really meant a lot to me. But it was a special group of guys, and it's too bad we never won any Stanley Cups, but that's the way she is. And you play against the best team in the world, and you stretch them some nights. And yeah, we got our lunch handed to them for a couple of years, but you know what? Hey, that's it. You shoot your shot, give it your best, and see what happens. I always say this, guys. There's a lot of better Blackhawks that played for the Chicago Blackhawks than Steve Ludwig, but there was nobody that was more proud to put that sweater on, and I thought about that every night I came to play. I really, really did cherish that.
One question I think is interesting to get your perspective from, you know, as a player and then transitioning to a coach. And it's one of the things that I sort of find fascinating to compare eras. We talk about that 80s team. I mean, the regular penalty killers on that team were yourself, Billy Gardner, Patterson, Troy Murray, you know, some other guys. I mean, you didn't see, I mean, Steve Lauber did kill penalties, but you didn't see Dennis Savard out there.
No.
I mean, you don't want to, expend those guys' energy. To whereas now, I mean, who are the guys that kill penalties? Jonathan Toews, Henrik Zetterberg,
yeah.
Pavel Datsyuk. It's become a very skill-orientated thing. Now, the question I'd have to ask you is that, was there something maybe in the coaching fraternity where, I mean, all that pressure, I mean, there's pressure on players to stay in the lineup, not lose your job, but coaches know that, I mean, their shelf life in some situations isn't very good. Was there a time that you think that coaches started to lean that way, where I got to go with skill all the time, otherwise I might be out of a job?
Well, you're dead on 100%. I mean, the shelf life of a coach is like a loaf of raisin bread. You know, like, I mean, you just don't have it, and you're either too nice or too mean or too grumpy or too nice, you're either here or there. But what you see in the game today is a direct result from coaches, and I don't exclude myself. Why did you see the trap? Why did you see the trap come in? Well, you saw the trap come in because coaches were losing their job left, right, and center. I said, well, I don't have a team. If I got a team in Tampa Bay, it's changed now, but I got a team in Tampa Bay that's total budget $16 million, and I'm playing against the Detroit Red Wings that are making $75 million. You have two ways to go: either run or run to fight another day. And unfortunately for Steve Ludwig, I never thought that was the way to play. I thought, go get them, go after them. So if you asked me would I change anything, and I know you didn't ask me this, but if you asked me would I change anything when I went to Tampa, I figured we were on a four-year plan. You don't teach guys to win by playing kitty by the door hockey. You teach them to go attack and return and know their down low coverage. But, you know, I'd rather get shot with like a lion than a lamb. And we just weren't ready to play that style in Tampa Bay. That's the only thing I can say that I would have done differently, nothing else. But what happens is coaches, why do you see the forechecker, the first guy that gets in on the play, comes in and arrives in a bad mood, like a heat-seeking missile? Why is that? Because that's what coaches tell them. The first guy get on that top of that forecheck. First guy get in there like a heat-seeking missile and disrupt that defensive with the puck. Now, they don't say knock him out cold or crush him, but that's the job, and then it'll never change. You're never going to hear a coach say lollygag or saunter or on the forecheck. It's a bang, bang, bang. It's methodical. It's quick. It's fast. And coaches, you know, now you see down low coverage. You know, coaches say, well, they used to be in the old days, just watch the points. Well, now they don't worry about the points. They block shots. That's why you're seeing 50, 60 block shots in a game, because guys, they'll give you the points. They'll say, you're not going to score on us down low. We've condensed to the house, we call it, to the little area in front of the net. And they've got to change some stuff, but every time they change stuff, coaches figure out how to counteract it, which is amazing, but that's the job. And why they do it is because they're scared to lose their job. And nobody has any confidence to say, you know what, I'm going to run with this team for a few years and look and see if I can keep my job. You don't keep your job unless you win. Then there's no excuses. They don't care how young you are, how cheap you are. You either win or you're gone, and that's the bottom line. And it's a tough way to make a living.
One other guy, now that you mention it, that's been in the news lately is a former Blackhawk coach, very controversial. There's been a lot of those. Mike Keenan of late has talked about wanting to get back into the NHL and maybe one last chance. Right. Mike Keenan was the guy, for you personally, that told you that you were no longer going to be a Blackhawk.
Right.
Mike Keenan, as far as how – I think there's this impression of Mike Keenan that, you know, that he's so out of touch, when in reality, I think what and you could verify this, what he was really trying to do as a coach, and has been ever since, is to really stir the pot and create, maybe animosity is the wrong word, but what he was really trying to do is find out which guys he could really trust, and, you know, any situation he could put out on the ice and trust. Can that work in today's game, especially maybe Mike, because we all know his game plan. We all know, you know, his tactics. I mean, can Mike Keenan still coach in this league?
Well, yeah. Let me get my answer out here. First of all, Mike Keenan was the guy that said to me that I wasn't going to play in Chicago anymore, and I'd sat for too long, and I wasn't part of his plans. That was right from training camp. So that's his decision. In fact, I worked for Mike in San Antonio as a coach of the American League team, and I got along great with him. As a matter of fact, April or October 5th, I've got a roast for him here in Niagara Falls, and I'm the MC of it, and it's for Parkinson's disease. So it's an amazing story. Like, I didn't hold any grudges. That's business. That's hockey. You know, I did, and he was right. I did take some severe injuries to my body over the years in Chicago, and I was an old 28-year-old guy. That's for sure. Do I think it's right? Nobody's going to think it's right, right? Could Keenan coach today? Yeah. Daryl Sutter is just the same type of guy. Daryl Sutter's not an X's and O's guy, and Mike Keenan's not an X's and O's guy. Daryl Sutter's a stay-in-your-face guy. Mike Keenan's a stay-in-your-face guy. Daryl Sutter's a high-intensity guy. Mike Keenan's a high-intensity guy. It's an interesting question. Do I think you'll get another chance? Well, I hope so. I hope everybody makes a living doing what they want to do. But I don't think it matters, really. The game's so technical now that you have coaches for power play, penalty killing, even strength, four-on-threes, neutral zone play. You got a dozen coaches out there now working with guys. You come in and you want to see a play, just ask a guy that's taping back there and goes, give me that giveaway that happened in the third period. And they got about four or five of them they'll show you. So Dex is an old, he shouldn't worry about that. I'd like to see him get another shot. I thought he did a pretty good job in Calgary, and I told him that. He did a good job in Calgary, and unfortunately, Jay Feaster showed up there.
Well, I think the thing with Keenan is that he probably needs a real strong character, good cop on that bench too.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And I think he
had a great guy in Rich Preston with him, and I'm not quite sure that the other coach that worked with him was the exact same type didn't have an agenda. You can't be a head coach and have assistant coaches that have agendas to be head coaches. That's just not going to work. It's just not going to work. It didn't work for me in Tampa Bay with Tortorella, and it doesn't work anywhere else. You have to have the assistant coach ready to face the bullets with you. And if you don't have that, then you're in trouble. You're in big trouble. And guys that have coached in the NHL know what I'm talking about. That's just the way it is. And you're kind of in the foxhole by yourself sometimes.
Two last questions. One more about the 80s Blackhawks. Personally,
right.
For me, I think in my lifetime, which is 34 years now, the party line, Dennis Savard, Steve Larmer, Al Secord, even to this day, the best line that I've ever seen in a Blackhawks uniform. I still don't think they get their due. How great was that trio to play with? Or just watch?
Yeah, I would agree with you. They're one of the top lines in history. Larmer was a guy that came late on the play and could finish. Dennis Savard was the creative spinorama dancing master who electrified everybody, that could bring the crowd to their feet and on any given night would be the best player on the ice, depending how he felt. He could dominate a game like nobody could, and when he got his fire up, he was unstoppable. Now, Al Secord, the left winger on that line, nobody dominated the game more physically and in more of a dominating manner than Al Secord. He scored 50 goals, I think, three times, maybe four. He fought every tough guy in the league. He was feared by everybody. He went to the net like 10 men, and he could put the puck in the net. I can't think of anybody that could do that for 4 or 5 years that he did. I can't, for the life of me, think of any player that did exactly what he did. And what happened to him, people don't know this, he had a stomach pull, and it didn't get treated properly. And he was getting cortisone shots into it, and they were screwing around with this and that. And he missed, if you look at his record, and it never gets brought out, he basically missed about almost 2 years of hockey. And he was at the height of his game, and he never really got it back. And then he got in a position when he got traded to Toronto where they wanted him to fight the big boys. And I remember thinking, geez, he's 30 years old now. Like, fighting's for younger guys. And Al Secord is a pilot now in Dallas, Texas, I believe, and he called me when he read my book, and he, as you were saying, he loved the book too. And no line had a better mix of character, skill, toughness, finish, check, back teams up on the road. I mean, Al Secord never gets any credit, but he was a huge part of that line because anybody went near Savard or Larmer, they had the answer to Al Secord. And a lot of guys didn't pick the phone up when Al was dialing them. They mysteriously found other ways of talking to other players or bothering other players. They didn't bother with Savard or Larmer. They just didn't because they knew they had to answer to number 20. And, I mean, you want to screw around with Al Secord. You want to dance with him, you're going to leave a big tip. I'll tell you that much.
Last question. It's sort of a two-part question. But I want you to put, for people that don't know, in Canada, Steve, you are, basically like what NBC Sports or Versus here is in the States. You, for the Score and for TSN, were a hockey analyst. You still are.
Right.
So I want you to put your hockey commentator hat on. And right. First of all, Alan Eagleson wants to take part in the Summit Series reunion. I want your reaction to that. And two, last time you were on, you told us that hockey couldn't afford another lockout. We're about a week and a half away from one. Do you think we're headed for a lockout?
Well, to answer your first question, I was supposed to meet Al Eagleson about 2 weeks ago, and I had an appointment that I couldn't break. And I have a friend that is best friends with him. And he said if you met Al Eagleson, you'd really like him. And I couldn't make the appointment, unfortunately. He sent a nice picture to me. I'm not quite sure he was, the players were taken advantage of. There's some stories about this and that. He did want to be part of the 72, it's 40 years now, eh?
Yeah.
And he wanted to be a part of that, and the players vetoed that, right? But not all players hate him. Not many love him, but not all the players hate him. But he's a perfect example of ultimate power corrupts ultimately. Because he was more powerful than the Prime Minister of Canada at one time. He had that much power. He had that much chutzpah. He had that much clout. And what he said goes. And I don't know what happened, and I don't want to get sued, but something happened to the money. Something happened to the players. Became at the beginning, the players were better off with Al Eagleson, and then he became a drain on them. And there's a lot of stories out there, and I feel sorry for the players that were hurt by him.
Are we headed for a lockout?
In the lockout, I would say I don't think the owners will lock the players out. I think the players will have to strike. I really, for the life of me, for a guy that made it most in his playing career, I mean, I made four times more money coaching than I did playing, and I never thought about it until I, you know, got into coaching, but I was like, holy cow, really, we're making 100. Look, put it this way. Tony Esposito pulled out of the parking lot one year when we were in training camp, and Larm and I sat there and went, wow, he makes $300,000 a year. We were stupefied that anybody could make that kind of money. We used to kid him that the Brinks truck was backing up just to pay his salary. Now these guys get that for signing bonus. And I remember Stan Mikita. Have I got 2 seconds to talk here?
Yeah, go ahead.
I remember Stan Mikita saying to me, you guys will realize that when you get to my age and you look at the money these guys are making, you're going to be bitter. Well, I've never felt like that, to be honest with you. And I love Stan, and I hope his health well. I know he's battled a major illness and that. But I never felt any disrespect or disregard for guys. It's not their fault that the owners are crazy. They want to pay a guy that scores 3 goals $5 million. You know? That's their business. I think they have to have a CBA to protect the owners from themselves. They're crazy. 15-year contracts. $100 million. Like, how can you give contracts like that and say we're broke? Come on. And on the other hand, if a guy spends $200 million for a franchise, doesn't he deserve to make a couple of shillings along the way? You know. But to answer your question, I definitely believe there will be. I was talking to Scotty Bowman this morning, and he felt the exact same way.
Yeah, just to put things in perspective, when you first came into the league, Steve, the cheapest ticket to get inside the Chicago Stadium was $4. Right now, the cheapest ticket to get inside the United Center is $54, and it costs $450 to sit downstairs. I mean, the stakes are just so high that, I mean, there's so much, so much money out there that there's only going to be this kind of fighting going on over it.
Well, you know what? I can end this story, this interview, which has been great. I've really enjoyed it. By telling a story about the first time back at wasn't the Chicago Stadium, it was the United Center at that time. I was coaching Tampa Bay, and I used to have a lucky charm where I'd walk around the top of every rink that I went and visited. Just walk around at about 6 o'clock, 6:15, just a good luck thing. And I happened to be walking around the United Center, and a guy was carving up roast beef. He had those famous roast beef sandwiches there. And he said, Steve, nobody's going to recognize you up here. And I said, yeah, I know. He goes, the money they paid back when you played to get a ticket was so cheap. And you could buy a hot dog for that now, for the money that you paid back then. But I got a ticket underneath my bar, Chicago Blackhawks versus the Edmonton Oilers, semifinal game, $12.
Yeah.
$12. I mean, that's unbelievable. Really unbelievable. But it's a different crowd. It's a higher end volume, but I'm not saying it's a better crowd. I mean, nobody can beat the Chicago fans from the Chicago Stadium, and I still get chills and goose flesh popping up all over the place when I hear the national anthem from an old film. They have this old classics channel back here in Canada, and you sit there, man, I was part of that. Like, I remember just being pumped up. If you had an ache or pain or anything, it instantly went away when you heard that national anthem. You couldn't hear the last four or five bars of it because the fans are so noisy. And some of the best fights took place in the crowd sitting on the ice.
Oh, I know.
It was unbelievable.
Some nights walking down from the second balcony after a game was, you know, you had to hold on to those railings and just pray.
Well, it was a unique setup, the way the seats kind of sat on top of each other. So it kept it. And people don't realize the gate 3.5, some of those guys, they got a good old beating from the policemen. They caused trouble in the stadium. They got them into the bathroom at gate 3.5, and guess what? It wasn't a nice thing. They didn't want any trouble down there, and they were tough guys, and they didn't fool around. Kenny Remchuk had a buddy that almost got pulled into the gate 3.5, and just before he was ready to get a licking, he said, "Hey, I'm Kenny Remchuk's best buddy from Edmonton." Just before he got the kibosh. But they didn't fool around, boy. And they had to be tough guys because the Chicago people, you know, what I love about them is they're tough, tough, tough people. And all they want is somebody to – you don't have to be the best player. You don't have to be the greatest player. And you might get caught with two left skates on one night, but you have to give them an effort. And that's when – you know, I go back to Chicago every year just for – with my wife and very, very proud of the fact that I played in that city. Very proud.
All right, Steve, well, hopefully we have hockey this year, and hopefully we'll get to see you here in Chicago.
Absolutely. Remember the website, folks, oldteammates.com. That's oldteammates.com, just the way it sounds. And I love all the – get the big Chicago section on my website, and I like to say hi to all my buddies, Jack O'Callaghan. I talked to him the other day, and all the boys are doing great, and it's great to be with you guys, and you call me anytime you want.
All right, Steve, definitely. You need anything, just give us a call.
Does the superstar say anything, or does he just keep quiet the whole night?
I pretty much keep quiet all night,
yeah.
Do they pay you for that job, superstar, or what?
Yeah, Block picks up the occasional bar bill, so that's good enough for me.
Beautiful. Great talking to you, Chris, and a great interview, and thanks for the time.
All right, Steve, we'll talk to you real soon. And, again, that's Lugsy.com and also oldteammates.com, and we'll get the links up on the website for you.
Thanks,
Bob. Thanks very much for your time. Very generous tonight, Steve. And,
thank you.
Have a good one.
Thank you.
All right, good night. All right, superstar.
All right. Another outstanding interview.
It was 70 minutes with Steve. That was terrific. Did you have anything that you didn't get to ask?
You know, I wanted to ask him a few things, especially about the Parkinson, and if that he's involved with any sort of, you know, fundraising charity. You know, obviously, I'm sure Michael J. Fox, Muhammad Ali both have, you know, foundations. If he was thinking about possibly, you know, getting into that, starting a foundation, anything to kind of help raise money to fight Parkinson?
That would have been a great question.
I'm shocked you didn't ask it. And, you know, and then you, a lot of the old 80s stuff, and, you know, he's gone through so much, not only here, but in Tampa and all through the juniors. And I'd really like to know, not what his favorite memory of his hockey career from start to finish is, but what's the most memorable? You know, memories aren't always a positive thing, but what's the one thing that really sticks out, you know, good or bad?
Well, I mean, we're definitely going to get Steve back on, and it's a crime that it took us as long as it did, which I take full blame for. But, yeah, I mean, I have so many things that we could talk to Ludzie about, and it's a shame that, well, first of all, we're very fortunate that he's willing to come on for 70 minutes and talk, but we'll get him back on. I really wanted to touch on the Orville thing for people who haven't seen it. I'll put the video up on thethirdmanin.com, puckchatter.com, when I post the audio on the site tonight. But if you didn't see it, I mean, it's such a terrific. I mean, these are two guys in their era. I mean, Ludzie wasn't a star in the NHL, but if you were a fan of the Blackhawks, he was a component of that team, and obviously Steve Larmer is just a huge star. And for those two guys, even in retirement, to take a day, you know, I mean, that's just something that you don't I mean, I'm sure it happens, and I actually know that, I mean, it's heard of other times that it's happened, not with Orville, but, I mean, for those two guys to go out and do it, not just do it, I don't think that it was necessarily, showing off or however you want to say it for them to videotape and put it on. I thought it was just terrific that they shared that moment for fans of the 80s Blackhawks and just history. You don't have to be around. If you're just a fan of history and you never got to see Orville Tessier behind the bench, you just heard about him, I just thought it was just an awesome thing that they did and that they shared it, a part of that with us. As Steve pointed out, Orville's not, he's doing all right now. I don't know about right now, but he was doing better than he had been, in the months before. So I thought it was just fantastic. So I wanted to do that, and of course, there's just so much to talk about. It would be great just to talk to him for an hour about, just Blackhawks and coaching philosophies and other things pertaining to what's going on now and his thoughts. Because, again, he's just, he's a straight shooter. There's no question about it.
Absolutely. And you said it best. I mean, for him to even, take an hour and 15 minutes out of his time and, his life to spend with us, that's pretty amazing.
I would say so.
I think that my favorite part of the whole interview, though, was his wife doing the dishes in the background.
I talked to Marianne the other day, and she's a very, very sweet lady. I almost was ashamed to be on the phone with her. She's such a nice person. that was for once someone was making a racket in the background and it wasn't you, Superstar.
I know. Can you believe it?
We don't have much time here. So, the CBA stuff, it's not looking good. There's going to be a meeting, Board of Governors meeting called in New York, 2 days, the September 15th falls on a Saturday. On the Thursday, there'll be a Board of Governors meeting, which basically the owners will vote clearly on whether or not a lockout, the majority of the owners are in favor of a lockout. That's expected to happen. And, what we talked about it last week, I talked about it. I mean, it basically went exactly like we said. Right now the owners are negotiating with themselves and the players are negotiating with themselves. They're not negotiating with each other. And until something happens to draw them closer together, which the only thing that's going to be is a work stoppage, in my opinion. It's empty buildings, it's people out of work, and it's players sitting around getting antsy. I think that's what's going to draw them together. I think it's going to take some time. I hope it doesn't. I mean, I don't want to – I mean, as much as anybody else, I want NHL hockey to start up the beginning of October. I'd love to go to the United Center at the end of this month and watch some exhibition hockey. I just don't see it happening. Neither side is in a hurry to give in on any of the things that they want. And forget about revenue sharing. Forget about – the percentage of revenue that the owners want to give the players, how much the players are willing to give back. The owners want such considerable concessions and contracts, and a lot of that stuff gets real messy. And then the word today out of New York was that the owners apparently don't want to be in a quote-unquote partnership with the players anymore. The owners don't want to have to go to the players, and don't kid yourself, and this is a two-way street, but when the owners and the Board of Governors ruled that they wanted to do realignment a year ago, or less than a year ago, and the players stood up and said, wait a minute, you guys just went ahead and constructed this thing and voted on it and didn't, we're supposed to be a partnership, and you didn't come to us. And now you want us to just ratify it, show us a schedule, show us how this works out. And, yes, it was posturing. Yes, it was politically motivated by Donald Fehr. Because if you look at that realignment, it made sense. But, Donald Fehr's like, wait a minute, we're supposed to be in a partnership. You know, we feel like you should have came to us about this. So the player said, no, we're not voting on it. Well, that's where this is coming from. The owners are saying the players aren't, and you could think of it as right or wrong, the players aren't always going to side on what's the best interest of the game. And I think, you know, again, I mean, you could argue either side, and you wouldn't necessarily be wrong, but that's where this is coming from. The owners want unilateral power on decisions on realignment, expansion, other things like that, and that is a humongous, acorn that they just threw down. And it's, like we said, it's going to get real ugly real fast, and that's where it's going. And it's unfortunate, but like I said, there's so much money at stake here. I mean, really what we need is the fans need a union to fight for them, because they're fighting for all of your money, my money. And we don't we just keep throwing into the pot, and the owners and the players keep taking, but there's nobody fighting for us. And that's just the way it's going to be. And it is hard and is frustrating to sit aside and watch it happen and be powerless. But that's the way it goes. The NHL, it's an entertainment company, and we pay them for entertainment until we say, well, you know what, screw this, I'm going to go take my entertainment dollars somewhere else. We don't have any power. And unfortunately, or fortunately for the game of hockey in the NHL, that fans that become hockey fans tend to be very, very loyal. And I don't see that changing. So they're going to figure this out, and then when they do, we'll all go back, and it'll be bittersweet, but like 2004 or 5, eventually we got over it. And it, for most, a lot of us, it didn't take very long. But so that's that. I just got back from Las Vegas, Superstar.
I saw the debacle.
I am really, really red and peeling all over.
It's not good, dude. It really isn't.
I know. Well, I've heard about this for 2 days now, so I believe me. I'm hearing about it. Basically, the gist of this was, I'm not so bad on the rest of my body, but for whatever reason, I just thought, like, if I was going to sit in the pool for 8 hours a day, every day over the weekend, that I didn't need to put sunscreen on my face at all.
Yeah, it's not a good combination.
No, I don't know. I can't tell you. Well, I mean, there were contributing factors, but how I made that gaffe, but it's resulted in me looking like a burn victim. I stayed in the office yesterday. I really didn't try to, I limited my mobility. But today it was like, oh my God, what happened?
Yeah, you gotta start thinking about your choices.
Superstar, for a long time now, I had to start thinking about my choices.
Yeah, definitely. See, that's why I like Vegas and the winter. Because a pasty white guy like me doesn't even have to worry about going out by the pool for 8 hours.
I got to tell you something, though. I met some great people, and a few of them are probably listening or will be listening to this at some point. We met some of this I probably shouldn't talk about, but we met a trio of women from Austria, Superstar, that were just, in every sense of the imagination, were out of this world. Austrian women have got it going on.
Nice.
Then we met.
They probably outdrank you too.
No. Okay. Well, I also met a couple from Finland on Sunday at the pool. We talked about Tuomo Ruutu. I told them the whole story about how I named my dog. They loved it. It's basically how I introduced myself. Oh, you're from Finland? We talked at length about Michael Granlund and the whole career of Teemu Selanne. They're a great poolside companion on Sunday. But on Saturday, I want to say this. We met some fine folks from Vancouver. And actually, it's not ironic. We ran into Vancouver people like all weekend. But this particular, two girls and a guy, basically we drank them under the table on Saturday or underwater to the point that on Sunday they were running from us. Like, they wanted to have nothing to do with it. They were even ignoring our gestures of saying hi.
Well, yeah, it sounds about right. The big question is you made it through a whole weekend in Vegas.
Yeah.
Now two part question. A, did you jump in the pool with your phone? And has the alcohol sabbatical started?
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, okay, let me tell you a story. So, first of all, did I jump in the pool with my phone? No. I told myself all the way to Vegas, and when I was there and walking around on Friday, I was like, don't take your phone to the pool box. Don't take your phone to the pool box. Because, as Superstar just said, my phone always ends up in the water. So, no, I never took my phone to the pool. The problem this past weekend was that I took my phone everywhere else. and you know how I am when I get drunk. I get a little texty.
You get a lot texty.
I do get a lot texty, and I was making mistakes with my phone, and that was no good. In many respects, but to answer your second question, has the sabbatical started? Yes. By the time I got to, because what happened on Monday was that I had like all day to be out and about. And, of course, you know, I was drinking, I was gambling and everything, and I hadn't had very much sleep. And I'm sitting there, and I was sitting there playing blackjack next to the cutest blonde that you'll ever see. And I'm sitting there, and I literally have like an hour to go to the airport. And I'm sitting there, and I'm playing blackjack, which the object of the game is to get to 21, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have cards in front of me that total 20. So what did Block do? He hit on 20. and that's when I knew my weekend was over.
That's a good indicator that you should probably grab what chips that you have in front of you and leave.
Yeah. I said out loud, I turned to the girl sitting next to me, I said, I just hit on 20. And she's like, yeah, that's not suggested. I said, I got to go. I already had people looking for me, going frantic, which is, that's how usually how my Vegas weekends end.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I get to the airport, and I get a cab, and I tell the cab driver, like, you got to get to McCarran as fast as possible because I'm going to miss my plane. He gets me there as fast as possible. There's, like, nothing going on at this airport on Labor Day. I don't know why, but I breeze through security. I go to the gate and I look at it and say, I got about 25 minutes till I board. So I think to myself, I go, oh, I'm not going to be able to drink for 12 days after this, right? So I said, I'm going to go to the bar because technically I hadn't left Las Vegas. So I found a bar and I ordered two Stellas. Well, not at the same time, but I ordered the first Stella. I ordered the first Stella because it's the king of beers, and I drank it. And then I looked at my watch and I said, "Oh, I still got some time." So the bartender was a jolly man who I was talking to, said, "You want another?" I said, "Yeah, I got time for another." He's like, "You want to do a shot of Jaeger with that?" I said, "Why not?" So I did the shot of Jaeger and the Stella. And then I finished those. I walked up, and I noticed that they're boarding. I went to the bathroom. I got on the plane, and the next thing I remember, I was in Chicago.
Those are the best flights.
Yeah. But then I had – because no one really likes me, So it's like it was like 11:30 at night, and I just never thought to ask for anybody to give me a ride home. So I had to take the last train from, and I hate flying out of Midway, but I flew out of Midway. I had to take the last train from Midway downtown to catch another train to get back to where I was. So I get my bag, and I'm walking, and there's this really, really cute brunette who's, like, standing there, and I remember she had, like, red pants, and she was just, like, looking at me because she knew that I was completely out of it. I was lost. I had no idea what was going on. And I said, because I'd never taken a train from Midway before. In the past, people have liked me. And I said, she looked at me. She's like, you look lost. I said, I need to find the train. She's like, oh, well, follow me. And luckily, I mean, I don't know, like, guys, who is not picking this girl up at the airport? I mean, this was ridiculous. But, she ended up being on the same trains as me. She got off at Logan Square. I felt like I should have, like, got off and made sure she got home safely. But that would have been weird.
That would have been really weird.
Yeah, so I stayed put. And then, of course, I get off the train, and there's no buses because it's 1:30 in the morning on, Labor Day night. So I had to walk 20 minutes dragging my suitcase. So the moral of that story is next time I'm going to think about asking Superstar to come pick me up at the airport after I get back.
That's probably a wise decision.
Yeah. All right, so that's about going to do it. Unless you have anything else you want to talk about.
Not really.
All right, well, I have plans for next week and a guest. I do. But I can't talk about them. But
it'll be good, though.
I think we're going to have two shows next week, but we'll see how it goes. I mean, we have a hard enough time doing one show a week, but I think we're going to have two shows. We'll see how it works out. But until then, again, want to really thank Steve Ludzik for coming on and doing the show. When he and I were talking about doing this, I never told him how long we would have him. And, I think he knew that it was going to be over a half an hour, but for him to hang out for 70 minutes or 75 minutes, just outstanding. Thanks very much. Again, that Ludzi.com. You can buy his book, Been There, Done That, and also check out oldteammates.com. If you played hockey at any level, just join up. I mean, it's a terrific idea to keep in touch. Or maybe just see what your old buddies are doing what they're up to. But, again, thanks, everybody, for joining us. We'll be back next week sometime. Superstar, say goodbye to the people.
Goodbye, people.
All right. TheThirdManIn.com, PuffChatter.com, and BlogTalkRadio.com // The Third Man In. I think I got all that right. It's time to go. Good night, everybody.
And then I gave it all away. It's not the world that's heavy, it's just the things that you save. And I'm drifting, drifting away. Oh, drifting, drifting, drifting along. I rid myself of worries and my worries were gone. I only run when I want to and I sleep like a dog. I'm drifting, drifting along. Cause there's money to be made. They get so excited, nothing gets enough. I feel like going back there, but never for long. I sometimes wonder if they know that I'm gone. I'm drifting, drifting alone. Drifting, drifting alone. Oh, drifting, drifting alone.
Golf's no different from hockey. Requires talent, self-discipline.
Golf requires goofy pants and a fat ass. You should talk to my neighbor, the accountant, probably a great golfer, huge ass.
What's the worst thing that can happen?
Well, you'd be embarrassed and humiliated in front of a large group of people and have to walk out in shame with your tail between your legs.
Yeah, so?
Yeah, I see what you mean. I forgot who I was dealing with.